Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Donaldson Files here on the Bastrom News Radio Network. We'll be joined shortly by Wilfer Riley. He's going to talk about a new study that he is working on for the foundation dealing with charter schools, public schools, and plaques, and performances and how it all fits out. Also, we wanted to let you know that Jim Eccles will be trying to get him on the show in the future, because he's working on a interesting paper dealing with Black entrepreneurship, past and present, the obstacles, but also some of the historical fact, kind of detailing the fact that Black entrepreneurship, even in the worst of times, was rather impressive. And we're gonna So Jim will be joining us on a future program dealing with that, but it is his birthday today, so I'm going to wish Jim, my good friend, a happy birthday. And also let you know a couple of other announcements here that we wanted to kind of detail, is that Coco Konski is officially going to be rejoining the show October, that she's had some issues, and her dog Reagan has been under some very serious health issues. And the last time I talked with her, that they've been doing a lot of testing, and from my perspective, may not sound good. So I'm hoping it's better than what I'm hearing, but just to let you know, but in October, she plans to be back on the show in October, so we're going to be seeing her. And today I had a very interesting conversation, and the conversation went like this. It was fascinating because I'm in a secret location somewhere in Florida with members of the right wing conspiracy as we planned our continuous resistance to the Biden regime. And if you look at this lady, I mean, she's a very sharp gal. I mean, she's like, but you know, if you were to look at it, because she has really long hair, almost down, down to her waist, fifty years ago, she would have looked. We would have declared her as a hippie, and we got into a conversation because she was talking about her son in college and his struggles with left wing professors, detailing this, and we were talking. Finally, she said, "You know, Tom, you and I are no longer the establishment. We are the counterculture." And I thought to myself, you know, here I am, 67 years old, a man of the establishment. At least I thought I was. And now I come to the realization that she's probably right. I am a member of the counterculture. We are the counterculture. Whereas Johnny Rotten, the former lead singer of the Sex Pistol, who recently made this observation, that he didn't think he would live to see the day where it would be the right wingers who would be giving the middle finger to the establishment, and it would be the left who become the establishment. So, and now I'm going to bring on the air with me, Professor Wilfer Riley. Well, Professor Riley, how does it feel to be a member of the counterculture?
This is actually something that I've thought about before. Now, I was actually a member of the actual left-wing counterculture as well. When I was in college, I was an Occupy fighter and was at one point asked to lead a unit of Occupy Chicago. So, I mean, I still have my mask at home and all that sort of stuff. I mean, this is when I was maybe 25, 24. So, I mean, there was that. And then there was a specific reason I left the left, as people have said, since Horowitz and so on. Stuff, putting it politely, seemed never to get done. There was constant infighting between, whites, blacks, gays, straights, men, women. I come from a business and military family, so it struck me that these people just sort of didn't have their crap together, like the revolution wasn't coming. But I think that a lot of those ideas, fascinatingly enough, did make it into corporate America. There's a great book about this from a guy I'm casually friends with, Vivek Ramaswamy, called Woke Inc., that's out right now. And his point is that if you are a pro-abortion, ex-hippie, party girl who's done some sex work, who's in business, you're not a housewife, you're no longer seen as, you know, a rebellious career girl. You're the absolute mainstream. The media is 93% left-wing. Academia is 95% left-wing. So there's an element of truth to that, in that when you look at, like, the most radical things that, like, the religious right or the alt-right says, it's all stuff right out of the 1960s. Like, I mean, I disagree with the claim, like, racial integration didn't work that well, but the other stuff, like, feminism has its downsides. We should really be careful with these new sexual identities. You know, a lot of women are happier in the home, just on and on. Like, these radical ideas, quote-unquote, are just the most absolutely trash concepts that everyone believed for 100 or more years. So, yeah, that is kind of funny. And, I mean, I don't think we're alone in noticing that on kind of the right or the center right.
Yeah. So I would like to say, it was one of the things, that because there was this conversation, but, you know, there's a, as you say, there's this element of truth that you just look at and just say to yourself, yeah, wow. I mean, you know, there's some element of truth here because if you, you know, you look around you, you know, the very thing that you and I have been standing for are seeming to be more and more the things that are no longer just, you know, are kind of been put to the sideline. And you know, and if you go to any college, most college campuses, you know, being a member, a conservative, a member of the right is basically an act of rebellion. It's like I say, it's the, I just thought it was a fascinating conversation that we had this morning with her. I had, you know, with her because, I mean, it's kind of interesting. Like I said, when I, if you were just to look at her, you know, somebody, you know, if you, she would walk up to you, your first response would be, you know, something out of the 60s, in the, you know, the late 60s. I mean, the way she dresses, the way she keeps her hair, and, you know, and yet, I mean, she's, like I say, I guess now it's the new, I guess now maybe it's time, you know, I guess if I was at the point where I could actually grow my hair as opposed to losing it, I could now regrow my hair long and become a the ultimate cult, you know, the ultimate cult, the counterculture there.
Well, you actually, I mean, if you've ever partied with some of the people on the right, like I never have personally, but some of my Regnery co-authors have with Steve Bannon, I mean, a lot of people are almost going for that Jack Posobiec. I mean, people are going for that sort of pirate image. I mean, and there are things that the left and the right both have in common, like aggressively competing with the other side, being funny, being witty, you know, liking dancing and sex, although in the context of different relationships, so on. So you can present that image from either side of the political line. It's just that traditionally the people who are the rebels have done it. So the people that are the mainstream are buttoned down in the suits and so on, and then you have the hippies dressed in these flamboyish, outlandish costumes looking like gay Vikings and so on. But now, I mean, again, the people that are in the suits, if you look at the deanship board of a top state college like my own, or you look at the faculty regency or something like that, most of them are going to be on the political left. I mean, I think the campus is actually a good example of what you're saying, where, I mean, in many situations, it's not hard to express yourself as either a liberal or a conservative, being honest. But on a modern university campus, again, you're talking about 80% of the students probably are to the political left, often the far left. You know, people are sitting outside the dorms just smoking weed and tossing frisbees to each other while hip-hop plays. So, yeah, if you showed up in a standard blue blazer for, like, a campus dance and said you were, and mentioned to people that you were a Republican, it would absolutely be viewed as a edgy, outlying thing. Some girls would love it. Others would wonder about your stance on choice, you know. So that is funny. And I think in response to more of the people in suits being on the left, you're definitely going to see more pirates on the right. And, I mean, when you look at anyone from Donald Trump to Cernovich, to for that matter, Tucker Carlson not really caring anymore. I mean, a lot of people are sort of saying, like, this is more the revolution. This is more the backlash. And I don't think that's entirely bad.
No. Yes. Well, like I said, it's just one of those things. I mean, I said it was just one of this conversation because I'm reading, you know, like I said, I'm not going to take anything Bob Woodward seriously with his latest book, but I'm sitting there, you know, he stood there talking about, you know, General Miley and how he was about ready to arrest Donald Trump for, and I thought to myself, the more I'm reading this article, I'm thinking to myself, you know, wait a minute. Yeah. You know, what he's describing is a military coup by the general. Again, I'm not going to say Woodward's never, you know, it sounded like something out of the 7 Day of May, only it's the complete reverse. In fact, if you remember the movie, you know, a good portion of the media at that time was supporting the right wing general who wanted to do a coup. And today, you could probably go on CNN and say, "Thank God for General Miley," you know, who played the Burke Lancaster character. I mean, it's amazing how things get completely reversed within a generation. But let me take a quick break here. Go ahead, real quick, and then.
No, no, I was just going to say, I mean, like, the base of the Democratic Party, the unions and so on, is no more powerless or moral than the base of the Republican Party. If anything, it's the reverse. So, yeah, when they're in power, they'll behave in the same way. I mean, a left-wing general can as easily implement a dictatorial policy on diversity as a right-wing one can on anti-communism, yeah.
Well, this is Tom Donaldson. We're going to be right back with Wilf O'Reilly. We're going to talk about his most recent study that he's doing with us here at the Foundation on Education. This is Tom Donaldson here at the Bachelor News Radio Network and the Donaldson Files.
A boy born in Joplin, Missouri was fascinated by anything with wheels and a motor. The odds of him going on to fascinate millions with his talent? 1 in 260,000. The odds of this born racer having 157 career top 10 finishes in NASCAR? 1 in 125 billion. But every driver seeks the pinnacle of their achievements. The odds of him winning both the Daytona 500 and the Brickyard 400 in the same year? 1 in 195 million. The odds of a child being diagnosed with autism? 1 in 88. I'm NASCAR driver Jamie McMurray, and my niece has autism. Learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Since Buffalo Wild Wings is always open late, here are a few things you'll enjoy. Buzzer beaters, wings in 21 signature sauces and seasonings, and great deals on food and beer. Grab select domestic draft beers starting at $4. $4 shareables like street tacos, fried pickles, chili queso dip, mozzarella sticks, and roasted garlic mushrooms, and deals on select liquor and house cocktails. Phew, that's a mouthful. Catch all of the late night action. Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports. Offers and participation vary. Please drink responsibly. Void where prohibited.
Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, you can listen to this show and other great shows on the Bachelor News Airtime.pro. Let me spell Bachelor for you. The BATCHLOR News.airtime.pro. And you can listen to this show and repeats of this show at 10 a.m. 10 a.m. and at 3 p.m. Every day. In addition to, we do also have StreamYard.com. And don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, following this show on this network is You and the Law, featuring Chief Keith Humphrey and Chief Virgil Green. It's a show that opens up honest conversation about law enforcement and their relationship with the black and brown community. So you can listen every Tuesday night following this show on this network, 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. And don't forget, you can also go on our schedule and get the bachelor.airtime.pro. So two great shows back to back, and all right, we're going to now start talking about, and again, like I say, I am going to say, and a full disclosure, Wilf O'Reilly has done research for the Americans for Journey Foundation, which I am the project director of and a research associate, and he now is working and soon will be completed a new study that he's working with us, dealing with charter schools and performances with black students. And I will start off by, first of all, tell us the general thrust of the study itself.
Yeah, well, the idea of the study is, are there things in society, for example, charter education, that improve outcomes for minority students and that would, for example, increase the black income if they were more common? And the short answer is yeah. The data here is a little more complicated than I thought. First of all, it's very difficult to get a lot of the data on the performances of state schools versus charter schools out of the different states. But when you do, what you see is that the kids in charter schools perform about as well as the kids in regular public schools, but there are very big differences between the two groups of students. So, I mean, I've broken down about 100 pages of this data right now. If you're looking at the black SAT average for students in state public schools, for example, it's 966 right now, which isn't bad. I mean, traditionally, the average for whites has been about 1,000. Whites are up to a little under 1,100 now. The average for black kids in charter schools is a 989.83, so it's a little better. But what you also find is that charter schools take almost entirely black children from lower-income, more troubled settings. So what I'm doing now is breaking out how they compare, those black charter school kids compare to black kids from equivalent public schools, and they're doing significantly better. So it's an interesting picture, but what you see with charters is that charter school kids do about as well as public school kids, but they are poorer, more troubled students to begin with. And so charter schools do provide sort of a path out there. I don't think there's much dispute about that. You also see that there's an incredible amount of diversity in educational performance among the states. And this breaks down, we're going to do some pretty serious analyses in this paper, so this breaks down along a couple of different variables, like access to charters, whether or not students go to them, they seem to encourage the public schools to compete, whether students, black or overall, are localized in a few dense cities, or whether they're spread out throughout a state that's more exurban, suburban. But, I mean, to give an example, the African-American score in the SAT exam, I mean, that goes from an average of 1115 in Minnesota, which is above the national average for white kids, by the way, it's a good job, down to 845 in Michigan, where the majority of students are in Detroit and Dearborn. So, again, you can look at what would happen to African-American education, or no, there's nothing poor, or a poor white education, right? Half of Dearborn is Caucasian. If all students got the sort of education that charter students get, so say once you adjust for class, there's a 120-point bump for charter students, what would happen if everyone had access to that kind of education? What would happen if everyone had access to the same quality of education that exists in, say, Minnesota, across the states, in Michigan or in Alabama? And one of the things about this paper is that we don't want that to be just a hypothetical. I mean, so you get into a lot of data crunching, but you find that if you see a heightened high school graduation rate, for example, for a group, you would also see an elevated income for that group. If you see an improved SAT for that group, you would again see better performance in life for that group. So a lot of these black-white differences, frankly, seem to come down to, it's not racism, it's not genetics, it's things like what are people in these large, frankly, often Democrat-controlled cities doing in the school system? Why is Michigan, I'm going to return to this, why is Michigan 300 points below Minnesota, an equivalent large nearby state when it comes to educating kids overall and especially black kids? So that's what the paper looks at. What are the outcomes that you can focus on changing, i.e. more charters, better education, so on, to make people do better in life? And I think I just gave the two big ones right there, but that's the focus of the research.
Well, let me answer this one, because here's the question, because you and I talked about this, and one of my objectives was that because let me say, you and I kind of approach each other on this as an idea, because I know you'll follow up. I know you've been a fan of Tom Sowell, and you're very much familiar with his most recent book and research on charter schools in New York. And what I was looking at, I'll be honest, we'll discuss this more a little bit later, as I was looking at, let's say, for example, with the McKinsey Group, you know, did an interesting research on students during the lockdown, and where they found, you know, where, let's say, both, you know, whites and blacks saw significant declines in test scores, and they were falling behind. Blacks more so, I think, if I remember my statistics, it was like 4 months versus 6 months, which would be, let's say, 33% to blackball and buy even more 33%. But they also took, you know, what they really were looking at is, okay, what does this mean for income down the road? I mean, if you keep doing this or something like this, you know, how much of an impact does this have on someone's income in the future?
Mm-hmm.
And they were very negative on the fact that, you know, this could have a significant impact. And that's one of the things I was kind of figuring out. Okay, you know, if you get more graduation, or if they do in fact succeed in charter schools, does this also mean that those blacks will end up down the road with higher income because of that experience? Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, you would have to imagine. Yeah, so yes would be the answer. There are a couple of different levels to this. I'm actually working out some of what might end up being a 30 to 40 page paper in my mind here. But level one is charter schools versus public schools. And to you as a client, I've been very honest up front about this. The charter school performance, either for blacks or all students, is often relatively close to the public school performance. What's remarkable about that, though, is that the kids that go into the charter schools are dramatically different from the kids that go into the public schools. So one of the least discussed facts in American education is that the charter school student body, which is, you might correct this, but 96% black and Spanish, something on that order, performs on par with the public school student body, which is 58% white. So that's the first point. I mean, and yeah, you would assume that if you, in fact, we don't assume this, we're going to find out. But if you take a kid from a ghetto school, whether that's a Hispanic school in Albuquerque, whether that is a black school in Harlem, for that matter, whether that's an Appalachian white school right here in Harlan County in Kentucky, and you put them in a school where they're going to perform at the national average, you're going to see them go on to live a better life. Like, so for example, we broke out a lot of metrics here, right? And the charter school college attendance rate is 54.4% for that black and Hispanic student body. So, I mean, that's a metric where charters are clearly winning. And, yeah, if you go to college, you make on average $400,000 or whatever it is more in life than you do if you don't. So that's step one. And step two, there are specific charter networks. So, I mean, either in this piece or in a follow-up, we can look at KIPP, for example, that produce better outcomes than that. So at one level, if you go to a charter instead of a public, you're probably going to do better. The same would be true for simply a Catholic school, by the way. At a second level, if you go to a good charter school like KIPP, you're going to do better yet. And the question to some extent is, what is KIPP doing that's so different from what even the other charter schools, but certainly the publics in a black or a poor white neighborhood are doing? And to some extent, I think we all know the answer, discipline, training, so on. But that does affect income.
Well, let me talk about part of that, because basically, first of all, number one, let's kind of let's define charter schools. You know, if somebody says to you, Professor, charter schools, you know, define a charter school versus, let's say, normal public schools.
Sure. A charter school, and this would obviously, I mean, you have to know this in the first paragraph before starting a paper like this. A charter school is a non-private magnet or lottery public school that's allowed to run under a certain specific model. So in the USA, ordinary public schools have to meet a few standards. I mean, you have to have accredited teachers with four-year college degrees generally, but not many. And any public school in a district that is accredited and that meets those basic standards simply to some extent operates. People think of their local public as, you know, the school down the road, PS 131. It's been there for 100 years. Charter schools in general are newer schools that operate under a specific ideological framework. So the idea of the KIPP schools, for example, is what's the motto? Work hard, be nice, compete. Their framework is that training people to be sort of young gentlemen, which involves a lot of hours of study, which involves training in things like politeness, manners, a big focus on getting into colleges, and people are encouraged to compete to get into college and to compete in athletics. Their idea is that that will produce a better student. The students are known as KIPPsters. So the charter schools generally have to appeal to, there are three different varieties of state board, but have to be recognized as an alternative to the public schools that's not run by the Catholic diocese or something like that. And they can then incorporate their philosophy on student learning into what they do. And then there are quite a few of these. There's Success Academy, which is just focused on straight performance in English and math. So far in my numbers crunching, that's been the best performing charter network. But so on down the line, I mean, you've got Afrocentric charter schools, sports-focused charter schools, but all of them are a non-traditional way of looking at the public school. You teach students based on this certain idea of what will make them learn. And, again, on average, they do at least a bit better than the public's, and I think we're going to see better than that.
Now, hold on to that thought. This is Tom Donaldson, Donaldson Files here on the Bassett News Radio Network with Will Ferreira. We are talking education. We're talking charter schools here on the Donaldson Files and Bassett News Radio Network.
Go, Caleb!
Come on, hit a homer, Jesse!
Let's go, guys!
Hey, did you guys know that kids who play sports earn more money when they grow up?
Of course. I knew that.
Hey, did you guys know that kids who read books have a bigger vocabulary?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Wow, jinx. Did you guys know that friendly children have more friends?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's true. I knew that. Did you guys know that winter babies are better at music?
Everyone knows that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, pretty obvious.
Yeah.
Obvious. Oh, hey, guys, did you know that most people think they're using the right car seat for their kid, but they're not?
Huh, I didn't know that.
I'm pretty sure I knew that.
I'm pretty sure you didn't.
Parents who really know it all know for sure that their child is in the right car seat at the right age and size. Visit safercar.gov/the right seat to make sure your child is protected. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
And ladies and gentlemen, when it comes to auto repair, it's
Napa Know How.
Napa Guy knows not to judge a man by his car's multicolored paint job or absence of modern gadgetry. Who cares if it's technically old enough to vote and the windows are powered by the strength of your left arm? Your monthly payment is zero, and it'll stay that way. Because with over 500,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, you can keep anything on the road. She may not be pretty, but she's all yours. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, back to the Donaldson Files here on the Bass News Radio Network. Don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, you can listen to this show and other great shows on the Bassett News Radio Network, and you get there by the bassettnews.airtime.pro, and every day this show is on 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. every day. So just go to bassettnews.airtime.pro, and you can listen to this show on a routine basis twice a day, every day, repeats of our great shows we have. And also, don't forget, tomorrow night, the Donaldson Files will be here, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, followed by Dr. Larry, the Resistance Hour with Dr. Larry and Tom. As I stated, I am somewhere in Florida at a secret meeting with my fellow conspirators. So who knows what we'll be discussing tomorrow night on the Resistance Hour. All right. Here's the question. Okay, obviously, first I want to kind of make one point. Charter schools are essentially public schools with a different mission.
Yes.
And I guess with the charter school, I know I didn't put this on my original question, but I didn't know whether or not you may have this information, but how did the charter school concept begin?
Well, I think, and again, we both are fairly familiar with education theory, but aren't educators. Yeah. Yeah, thank God we both went on and got degrees in different fields. So the exact date, yeah. So I may be a little off here. But I think the short answer is that in the 1970s and 1980s, a lot of people noticed that the schools weren't working anymore. So one of the things that, now you probably lived through this, you're a few years older than me, but one of the things people forget is how complete the social revolution we saw in the 1960s and 70s was. So you saw some things that I think we all agree are good, like the civil rights movement. So if you're a black or Asian businessman, you can now participate fully in society. But we also saw, you know, both mainstream and radical feminism. We saw the sexual revolution. I mean, Miss Magazine famously found out as late as 1970 that most men didn't know what a clitoris was. I think that's changed dramatically, but so has number of sexual partners, rate of STDs, you know, the anti-war movement. And sort of getting to the point, we also saw this in education. The idea that the schools should, for example, expand into bilingual education, that dates to, if I recall correctly, 77. the idea of therapists in the schools, the change of the curriculum away from the traditionally patriotic. And just as with a lot of other things, like criminal justice in the USA at this time, the schools began to perform more badly, I think would be an accurate way to put this, in terms of dropout rates and so on. And many people in education observed the problems that you were seeing with the schools. If you go back to savage inequalities in the 1980s on the left or the worm in the apple on the right, and they began to come up with these different ideas about what could fix schooling. So the big idea on kind of the center right, and I think this is where we both fall, and I think these are the best performing charter schools, was that the problem was obvious, that the schools had moved away from sort of traditional discipline, long hours in the classroom, smart teachers. Teachers' unions are generally considered to be a big problem by people that hold this position. And so a lot of charter schools like KIPP and Success Academy focus on that, what you could call trad model. But there were other models. I mean, there are charter schools based around the idea that you should be more accommodating to students and more open to what people want to learn. So you have Montessori mission charters, Afrocentrist charters. But your basic description of public school charter schools as publics with a different mission that are certified slightly differently, that's correct. And that began around the maybe 10 years into the modern era of education, when people began to ask a lot of questions about the public schools, with the left sort of calling them racist and the right saying, well, these don't work anymore.
Now, it's an interesting question, because let me put this way. I did have an education background. I mean, I was a political science major, but I did get an education degree. And this was, like I said, again, this was in the early 70s. And I will say it was the most fascinating experience, because I went to, then it was James Madison College, which was a premier teacher school in the state of Virginia. And it was kind of interesting because, you know, I would say they had a more, at that time, they had a more traditional view. I mean, literally speaking, I was in secondary education, and I remember comparing the number of education courses I took with a young lady who, you know, when I did my student teaching, you know, she sat down with me, hey, let's talk. Oh, boy, you really seem to know your subject matter. And I found out she was taking almost twice as many education courses in about one-third the courses in her major. And we're sitting there looking at it. She said, you didn't take this, didn't you take this? I said, no, not really, no, not really. And they said, well, basically, and I'm sitting there thinking myself, gosh, you know, thank God I basically took courses in my own major. But what was interesting is that I remember going to an interview with this school district out somewhere in Southern Virginia, and this guy gets on this concept of, you know, this new education, which I was used the word student-centric versus teacher-centric. And I'm halfway through, and I'm listening to this stuff, and I'm like, God, this sounds stupid, and I don't remember learning this. And interesting enough, after going through that whole interview, and obviously, you know, when you basically say to somebody halfway through the interview, God, that doesn't sound like it works very well, does it? To which the person looking at you like, boy, you're not, you know, kind of have this look in your face. And interesting enough, the next day, you know, they discussed this. It was like a half a day, and they discussed this theory. And they based, and I'm like, I mean, you know, at our school, it took a half a day to discuss it and dismiss it.
Yep.
That's why I can describe it. And I'll never
Don't disagree, basically. Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that. I don't mean to be rude about the. It sounds like you got the training in the right way, sort of. But I've always viewed education itself as kind of a useless degree. So, to me, I feel the same way about philosophy to some extent. I mean, to me, there are actual techniques and tricks you can learn in your profession. So I am a quantitative methodologist, which is what I am in my capacity when I work with you guys and other major think tanks and foundations, because I know how to do high-level regression analysis in a program called Stata. If I didn't know how to do that, I wouldn't be a quantitative methodologist. And there are similar things. Like, I've set in on ed methods classes where you learn how to ethically survey students, and I found them quite useful. You know, Socratic method teaching is quite useful. But a lot of the education degree seems to be stretching out something really, really simple, which is, you know, you talk to students and they listen into a four-year program. So, I mean, in general, in a lot of countries and in a lot of private school networks, what you're looking for are people that have had one or two education classes, maybe Socratic teaching or something like that, and then a full degree in their actual subject, because then they know what the hell they're talking about. Taking entire classes and, you know, different learning theories and the black learning style and so on, I mean, like you said, it often takes a half a day for intelligent people to look at that stuff and say, well, maybe there's nothing, you know, here at all.
Yeah.
And that, by the way, I don't want to keep promoting charters and Catholic schools and so on, but that's an advantage that the privates and the charters have. There's less control, if any, from the great teachers' unions. So there's no set requirement on what a teacher is. A teacher can be anyone smart that you trust around kids.
Well, here's like the whole mix of this whole thing. Because now again, this is like mid 1970s. And actually, interesting, I actually student taught at the school that I went to high school with. I mean, that's, you know, they had an opening, so they say, would you mind going back to school? I said, sure, why not? So I was dealing with teachers we were teaching me just 4 or 5 years earlier. And I'll never forget, there was this one teacher who sat me down. He said, Tom, you know all those educational courses? He said, I said, yeah. He says, I'm just going to tell you, in about 2 weeks, you're going to find out 90% of what they taught you is crap. and he was absolutely correct. In fact, the only courses that I could really sit back and say, yeah, that was useful, was my student teaching. Because it was basically, you taught, you did it. It was much like the same way, you know, I was in sales for we've been in the private sector. I was in sales for like 26 years, and I can always tell people, I said, look, I can teach you everything about selling in 20 minutes, the basic principle, and you'll spend the rest of your life learning how to do it, and then putting it to your unique style. It's something that I can't, you know, you just have to learn on your own in most cases. You know, and there are just certain schools. Education is one of them. You know, somebody once asked me, he said, you know, what's the best way to, this, you know, I remember years later, somebody asked me, what's your best improvement for improving education in the United States? I said, yeah, get rid of school of education. Get rid of school.
Yeah.
And there's another, like journalism is another. I can remember Howard K. Smith. For those of us in the 60s and 70s, we know Howard K. Smith because he was like an anchor man. And somebody asked about journalism, he said, Tom, and his answer was, I would rather have a guy with a liberal arts degree who knows something about the world as it operates. I'll teach him how to be a journalist for 3 months on the job. And to me, teaching was exactly that. You know, give me somebody with a subject matter, and you will learn on the job how to become a teacher. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. I'll be pretty blunt about this, actually. So first of all, I said that I think most of these degrees are a waste of time. I very frequently, when I'm playing ball or fishing with friends or just at the barbershop, will advise young men not to go to college. Less so for young women. And certainly if you want to be an engineer or something, I mean, we've got UK around here, we've got Georgia Tech around here, you need to go to college. But for a very large number of people that want to be something like a master mechanic, there's no real reason that the U.S. Marines or that man's army or an apprenticeship program or something like that couldn't do for you community college. We have that great BCTC system here. There's no reason that wouldn't work about as well as spending a hell of a lot of money to spend 4 or 5 years on a campus boning up your Frisbee skills. So I think one of the things that's going on here is that as part of kind of the educational industrial complex, we have, from whatever, you know, bowels of thought, we've spawned this idea that there are a lot more expertise degrees than we used to think there were. And I guess what I mean by this is we've always recognized that there's certain things that require a very particular technical skill that takes a lot of training to get. And it's not really a blue-collar skill, so apprenticeship is not appropriate. But, like, being a surgeon would be an example of this. Like, I don't think anyone would trust a doctor that hadn't gone to medical school. Being a lawyer, like, as you know, past your 1L year, what you're basically doing is memorizing the major cases and going against each other in moot court to practice with them. You need to know case law to be a lawyer. Being an engineer, I mean, I could really go on with this. Computer science is another good example. But what we've done over the past 30 or 40 years is take a lot of fields that used to be learned primarily on the job. I mean, you've mentioned journalism, you've mentioned education, but I would throw a bunch more in here. Hospitality, sales itself is a subset of business. I mean, obviously you can get a bachelor's in sales right now, so on. And we've made those degrees as well, even things like anti-racism education, if you look at D'Angelo courses. So people will now say absurd things like, I am an expert in racism. And I tend to think of most of this as just being a waste of money. Like, first of all, you can't be an expert in racism. It takes 15 minutes to explain what racism is. And from that point forward, it's what you said. It's a know-it-when-you-see-it kind of situation. And point two, I think a lot of these degrees tend to attract stupid people. So every couple of years, there's a breakdown of what the GRE scores or the LSAT scores or the LSAT scores are, SAT scores, are for people entering certain fields. And in general, and I don't mean to mock everyone in these fields, but for people that are going into journalism or sales or elementary education or something like that, as opposed to getting a community college degree and then experimenting with maybe an entry-level position in that field, these are hundreds of points below what they are for people that are going into, say, banking or chemistry. So in very many cases, I guess, my impression would be that an ordinary smart person off the street might be more intelligent and more aware of what's going on in that field than someone with a degree in sales closing or magazine journalism or something like that. So a lot of people, I think, should save their money and go out into the business world if they want to learn something about what it's like to work on a trading floor or selling advertising or something of that nature. The degree itself confers more a feeling of expertise than the reality.
Yeah, hold on that thought, right? We'll be right back. We're going to follow up. This is Tom Dawson, Dawson Files, here on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
You might know me. I'm 50 Cent. You may follow my tweets, my Facebook friends. Odds are a few in 6 degrees separate us. We're that close. What's crazy is 1 in 6 don't know where their next meal is coming from. These are your coworkers, your neighbors, your friends. Hunger's too close for us to ignore. So visit feedingamerica.org/hunger and find your local food bank to see how you can make a difference. From one close friend to another, let's do this. I'm 50 Cent, and together we are Feeding America.
A message from Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Since Buffalo Wild Wings is always open late, here are a few things you'll enjoy. Buzzer beaters, wings in 21 signature sauces and seasonings, and great deals on food and beer. Grab select domestic draft beers starting at $4. $4 shareables like street tacos, fried pickles, chili queso dip, mozzarella sticks, and roasted garlic mushrooms, and deals on select liquor and house cocktails. Phew, that's a mouthful. Catch all of the late night action. Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports. Offers and participation vary. Please drink responsibly. Void where prohibited.
Welcome back to Dawson Files here on the Bachelor News Radio Network. I'm with Wilfred Riley, professor at Kentucky State University, and I guess I'm going to take a quick moment here since I did a poor job at the beginning of introducing you, Professor Riley. You are an associate professor at Kentucky State University. You're also the author of numerous books, including Taboo and are you working on anything, any other books? Yeah. Are you working on any books at the moment?
Well, I want to get this project done, and I want to get another book chapter for a book for Jason Riley, a buddy of mine, done. But after that, I've been asked to write 3 books, essentially. And what we're trying to do is see how those can fit together in a year. But one of them is a look at the actual kind of state of policing in the USA. We've heard a lot from Black Lives Matter and similar organizations about how American policing is experiencing a crisis. And I want to look at whether that's true in terms of, you know, number of officers suspended, number of people killed by police, so on down the line. And what I find actually is that policing seems to be functioning better than it has in the USA at any point since, you know, the 1960s, really. So we've seen a surge in recent years that's been called the Ferguson effect, but prior to that, crime was at its lowest level in 40, 50 years, and a lot of that has to do with broken windows policing, cop stat policing. So I'm going to give the flip side of this idea that the cops hurt too many people. What would happen if we returned to the more, you know, hands-off policing that we both saw in big cities as young men? So that's one. The second is a look at higher education, actually, and that's kind of close to the vest what's going to be in there. I don't want any overlap with your project. And I want to see what exactly the publisher's talking about. Are there specific schools they want me to look at? But a lot of those ideas that I'm hashing out right now, like too many people probably go to college, would be part of a book like that. And that's a fairly revolutionary thing for a college professor to say, but it's one of the big problems for young families today. I read recently that in Britain, the average man doesn't get married until he's 31, and we're moving toward that in the USA, a big reason for that debt. And finally, I've been asked about writing a book that's sort of the conservative or centrist flip of the old classic lies my teacher told me. Some of the things that for the last 30 years in kind of more liberal education have been said that aren't really true. You know, Native Americans were peaceful. You know, there never were any communists. McCarthy was going after no one. A lot of the stuff that our kids are learning now is just as nonsensical as that sort of Teddy Roosevelt jingo kind of stuff. It's just coming from the other direction. So, yeah, 3 or 4 potential books really within a year. We'll need to see if going back to sales, I and the publisher can absolutely close what the advance is going to be, so on. But I'm definitely not done writing.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Like I said, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, I'm now working in the editing process of getting a book published called "The America at the Abyss: Will America Survive?" which is basically a book that is a sequel to my original book, "The Rise of National Populism and Democratic Socialism." So we're both in the same process. But I want to kind of follow up with something here. Okay, you mentioned the idea going back, let's say, to black students. In public schools, charter schools. But look, I'm going to throw this out to you because, again, I can tell you, literally when I went to high school, 69 to 72, and I graduated from college in 76. And there was a lot of things that we had, history, we had geography, we had geometry, algebra, you know, 4 years of English and language and books, and which would include various classical literature like Moby Dick.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom Sowell made this observation about Dunbar. And by the way, I went to high school in Northern Virginia. So the school I went to was Jeff Storr High School, which is I've been now understood is no longer Jeff Storr High School because Jeb Stuart was a Confederate general.
Okay.
So, and I couldn't even tell you what the high school is other than they changed it 2 years ago or a year ago. But Tom Sowell made a very fascinating point about Dunbar High School in Washington, D.C. And he said this was one of the best public high school in the United States. It was like 90% black in the Washington, D.C. area. It was, it was a premier high school and then we're talking about a period of segregation because it was a segregated high school that was one of the premier high schools. And my question would be, and the thing I'm looking at here is that on one side of the equation, it is nice to be able to say, well, you don't need college. You can go through this. But the second side is, if you're not getting the basic education in the high school to begin with, the basic knowledge of grammar, literature, history, geography, geometry, mathematics, just the basics, these students are still losing out quite a bit. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think your second point, I would never say dismiss it, but I think we can both agree on that in a sentence. Like, yeah, I think that only empirical knowledge matters. Although I'm a spiritual man on the weekends, I'm not much for theology when people start explaining to me why God must be good if I want to describe myself as a Catholic. I'm not much for philosophy. I'm not much for education courses. I kind of want to see facts. And we see very consistently, again, if you look at the KIPP data, the Catholic school data, that people who go to schools that have a traditional curriculum, let's not forget a foreign language, do better than young gentlemen and ladies that go to schools that have a more relaxed sort of art, touchy-feely curriculum. And that's not inherently surprising. Liberal schools often say, well, we don't teach people rote memorization of Spanish. We teach them how to think. But you can't think in English or Spanish unless you can speak the language. You know, unless you know how nouns work with verbs and so on. So, I mean, those are two of your most basic classes, your English and your foreign language. And if you don't know how to do those things, if you don't know the phonics-based model for reading, for example, it's going to be very difficult for you to come up with some new genius-level enlightened discovery because you don't have that foundation. So that, yeah. I think, is true. But the Dunbar point is especially important because it ties into this whole conversation about whether black people are unique when it comes to education. Or you could say whites and POC if you want to get a little more technical. And I don't think so. Like, every debate about whether there's a genetic difference between blacks and whites, and every debate about whether racism slows us down a little bit, centers on what's usually projected as, like, you might correct this a little bit, like a 3 to 5% difference. Like, oh, this could hypothetically happen. My comment would be, well, why not focus on the other 90-plus percent? I mean, it's very, very obvious that if you train people in that same kind of classical fashion, you're going to get pretty similar results. So Dunbar, Paul Lawrence Dunbar High School, was the highest-performing black high school in the USA, if I recall correctly, during segregation.
Yeah.
But it was also one of the top five or six highest-performing high schools in the USA. And whenever the teachers at Dunbar were asked, well, what's your secret? They would just say, well, we treat Negro, they would have said, students like any other students. We have good teachers. They hired from the historically black colleges, and we don't tolerate a lot of nonsense. And it's worth noting that that wasn't alone. I believe it was Robeson in Chicago was right up there. There was a school in St. Louis. I don't want to mislabel. But the black schools under segregation, this is important to recall, weren't all failure factories. They were on average poorer than the white schools, so they performed a bit worse. But a lot of these problems you see in the black community today, 70% illegitimacy rate, SATs 200 points off the white mark, you didn't necessarily see those during this period. This obviously isn't an argument for segregation, but there is a legitimate question of why were things going better then? What do we need to relearn about the role of a father, or a tutor, or a good teacher?
Well, let me pause up. Here's the other point. Because I had this conversation with Jim Eccles very briefly, because we got to talk, Jim was looking at some of the historical aspects, like, for example, Tulsa, you know, which was the, you know, before the riot of 1921 was like the Wall Street of black America. And one example, and I've always thought to myself, you know, the conversation I had with Jim, I said, General, is there something that blacks have lost in the entrepreneurship, because in segregation, you had no choice. You know, blacks had to establish their own businesses if they wanted certain services. You wanted a stockbroker. You basically designed a stockbroker because of the segregation era that was black. And so basically. And it's the same thing with the education side of the equation, is, you know, what got lost in this? You know, one example I kind of think of is black baseball, major, you know, black, you know, Negro leagues, the old Negro leagues, where, you know, again, there's segregation. You know, Satchel Paige had one choice. He'd go play in the Negro leagues. But these Negro leagues were very successful. I mean, Branch Rickey, if you know, Branch Rickey was at that point where, how should I put it, he would look at an all-star game in the 1930s, a black all-star game, and see 50,000-60,000 people show up. And then he could go look at the St. Louis Browns, and they were basically lucky to get 1,000 people a game. You know, he knew an audience when he saw one. I'm looking at the same thing with the education side. This is not an argument for segregation. It is an argument that have we lost those, you know, has there been a set of standards that get lost on the way to integration, where standards that, let's say, made blacks successful in very difficult times, that they somewhat lose that, whether it's education or business. Your thoughts?
Well, yeah. I mean, so I think this whole issue of kind of postbellum race relations is one that's almost impossible to discuss, because you have to keep using these caveats that are very hard to maintain. Like, well, I'm not defending the Klan, And I mean, I think to some extent it should be obvious. No one's ever defending segregation or the Klan or whatever.
Yeah.
But black people under segregation, I mean, I think both groups at the time considered themselves to be kind of, you know, hostile former enemies, occupants of the same country, but maintaining almost separate worlds. The black world wasn't entirely a world of failure and misery. I mean, I think you'd have to be a racist to assume that. I mean, generally you had a town divided in two. The whites generally, of course, did have more money. But, I mean, the notable colored hotels, quote-unquote, in each city or the Negro League teams, I mean, were performers on par with their white equivalents very, very often, perhaps a bit down, but something that would surprise someone who's been taught that this era was just endless grinding oppression to see. So I think that's one point. Like, obviously, there were techniques that worked then that would probably work today. I mean, and again, they're very simple ones. Like, the best black schools, a lot of them were boarding schools, just like a lot of the best white schools. They had smart, no-nonsense teachers. They expected students to perform. I mean, Dunbar every year didn't want to be the best black school in the country. He wanted to be the best school in the country. So those are those techniques used there. But even beyond integration, I think that it's very difficult for us to discuss a lot of this. So when we talk about white flight, for example, from the cities, I think that the average idea from a black person or a liberal white would be something like, well, whites unprovokedly didn't want to live around black people, and so they left. And that doesn't really explain why did this suddenly happen. You know, by the 1960s, when many whites and black, many, at least among males, people had white and black buddies across that line, what suddenly occurred? And the reality, as you know, as I know, when you think of Kansas City or Detroit or Chicago, yeah, was that there were giant riots for years in the 1960s with the racist fighting that were caused by the death of Martin Luther King. So, again, there's a lesson there. Like, of course, people want to be friends with their athletic teammates or their coworkers across racial and religious lines, but you need good law enforcement for that to happen. You can't have a situation where if you walk into the black or the Italian or the Irish neighborhood, you're beaten to death. And that's what you had in the cities for a while. It was true for everybody, but it was easier for the whites to flee to the suburbs, and a lot of that was our fault, you know? So it's important to talk honestly about this. What happened in the 1960s? What ended integration in some of the cities? Collapse of law enforcement. You know, why were the black schools so good? Good teachers. Once we put aside these taboos, we can't talk about the pre-integration era and so on, then we can have a useful conversation.
Well, let me throw a follow-up there, because we got about a couple minutes left here. But I'm going to go back to the charter school, because it seems to me what the charter schools are essentially doing, and your research, you know, when you find it complete, may reinforce this, is a rediscovering the very basics that were successful regardless of the school systems. Because there are a lot of white schools that I can tell you are losing the same edge, you know, that you're not seeing the same quality of education as well. So, maybe to me, maybe you're discovering this, it may be interesting to see whether or not you do, but are we seeing a rediscovery of what was successful in the past?
I think we're seeing a lot of people get disgusted with systems failing when it's easy to make them not fail. I think we'd probably both agree on this. So my honest take as a friendly observer, as an upper middle class black guy, is that the white community is now dealing with a lot of this woke poison that disrupted our community. When you're talking about fatherlessness, increased welfare recipiency, crime. I mean, you know, black murders surged by a couple thousand over the past few years, but white and Spanish murders rose to meet them. We had 20,000 total murders last year. So these problems are now creeping into the white community, as you'd expect if there are fewer jobs, fewer fathers, so on. And I think a lot of people, both black and white, know what the solutions are. And that, when you look at Kemp and so on, Jeffrey Canada, that's what kind of what brought a lot of this about. Yeah. The problem I have with this is that I don't think we need charter schools set up in abandoned buildings doing this. I love them while they're here. I think we need the mainstream school system to teach these principles, and hopefully we'll get back to that.
Well, thank you very much. This is Tom Donaldson. I want to thank Wilfred Ryder for joining us. We're going to have you back on as your study is progressing. I want to thank you very much. This is Tom Donaldson, the Donaldson Files, saying good night.
Well, thanks for having me on, as always, Tom.
to you and the Law Podcast Show on the Bachelor News Radio Network. We want to welcome everyone that is tuning in to join me and my co-host who goes by the name of T-Swag Humphrey. So we've got a good topic that we're going to be talking about this afternoon, and it is going to be about police failures begin with bad leadership. So T-Swag, how you doing today, brother?
So look here, man. I'm doing good. I've told you, you're slipping again. I have told you that I am the host of this show, and you continue to say the co-host.
Oh, so you know what? You know, sometimes you be so silent, brother, that, you know, I just, you know, I forget. And so I'm glad that you are reminding me of your role and my role. So, it's clear now that I
am. So you agree?
I agree.
Okay. Let's move forward then.
All right, man. Well, hey, Keith, man, you know, we talked about leadership on the podcast before. We actually had on a guest a couple weeks ago who, you know, is a retired police chief out of South Carolina. He talked to us about leadership. And, you know, I think it's just really important that our listeners understand what happens when there is a breakdown in a police department, and what does that come back to? Does it come back to the officers, or does it come back to the leader of the police department?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. But I do tell you that the chief sets the tone, basically laying out their philosophy and the vision and the mission. But you've got to have that buy-in from under the chief. So assistant chiefs, majors, lieutenants, sergeants, they have to be pushing that down. That platform of accountability, that platform of integrity. So I think it's both.
Okay. Yeah, it is. And you know, so many things have happened over the years, Keith. When you go back to even talking about what happened in Ferguson, with the incident with Michael Brown and how that whole situation took place with that police department and with the police department surrounding Ferguson. And, you know, you can actually say without being biased that there was a lack of leadership that occurred, that happened when this incident happened with Michael Brown, because the police chief did not come out and immediately address the public. And there were just so many things that happened the days after that so many people questioned his leadership. And so when the community questions your leadership, do you think that now that those internally within the organization, do they begin to question the leadership?
Well, I think, let me say this. So the community will question your leadership when the officers are not are putting out certain things in the community. Now they're going to challenge your commitment, and they'll challenge your leadership based on a major incident. But for the most part, it's what the officers are out there telling the community. When you have officers saying things, and, you know, the chief can't answer all those questions. And then there's a lot of times when, you know, things come up and the community gets one side of the story, that can affect the chief's effectiveness. But I think that for the most part, the community believes in chiefs. The communities want to believe in chiefs, but when that one side of the story gets out, that can be damaging.
Yeah. And you know, Keith, and I think, you know, I think a lot of people listening to the show, whether you're listening to us live or you may listen to the rebroadcast show that airs on thebachelornews.airtime.pro, and they may say, well, hey, aren't you two guys, aren't you in that branch? Haven't you been in that branch? But you're talking about people that are just as equal, that are equal to you. And I think it's important, Keith, that people understand that to have these open conversations about things that are typically not talked about in this industry.
You do, Virgil. And I know that, you know, a lot of times they aren't the popular conversation. Well, they're not comfortable. They're very uncomfortable conversations to have. But at the end of the day, as a police chief, you are responsible for the safety of your city. You're responsible for the safety of your officers. And people do have to believe in you. And I've said this over and over again, Virgil, the situation in Ferguson, it wasn't because the chief didn't know. He didn't want to know. That wasn't something that just happened overnight. He didn't want to know. He backed off and basically released the dogs on the community. That's pretty much what he did.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, Keith, and this is, you know, and not just to be pick on Ferguson. You know, it's just a topic that we're talking about when we're talking about, you know, leadership. But when you also talk about when you look at leadership, and let's just look at Ferguson, for a community that is predominantly African-American, but an agency that was predominantly white males. And so you have to question and ask yourself, where was the leadership there when you are trying to recruit minority men and women to be a part of the police department? To me, that falls under leadership. If you are not trying your best, or you don't have things put in place in your organization to make sure that you are recruiting minority men and women in the profession, that also impacts your leadership.
Well, it does. You know, I think you bring up some really good points, because the community is who you're working for. And you've got to prove yourself to the community. The community doesn't have to prove itself to you. You have to prove yourself to the community, and that you are, you know, you are receptive to their concerns. And so, you know, just people have to remember that when you get into this job, you got to prove yourself. The community doesn't have to prove itself to you.
Exactly. And again, Keith, I think, you know, it just, when we talk about leaders, oftentimes people assume that, well, because you are in this position, you've got all of the credentials, you've got the education, you've got the knowledge. But oftentimes we've seen people that are being put into leadership positions who may not be the right person for that leadership role. But Keith, we're coming up and we're going to take our first break, man. But we're going to come back. We're going to get back into this conversation of why leadership in law enforcement, another aspect, why leadership in law enforcement is not all about the rank. But you're listening to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
Greetings and great.
A boy born in Joplin, Missouri was fascinated by anything with wheels and a motor. The odds.
Greetings and great day, everyone. I am Elder Janelle Strickland, host of the Life Cafe radio broadcast from Maximizing Life Family Worship Center. I invite you to tune in every Saturday from 5 to 6 p.m. Tune in, maximize your life with the Word of God, and be blessed. Only on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
Having trouble with math or science homework? Call Rose Holman Institute of Technology's Homework Hotline, a free math and science tutoring service for Indiana students in grades 6 to 12. Call toll-free 1-877-ASK-ROSE from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, Sunday through Thursday. And a Rose Holman College student will help you with your math or science questions. The tutors are patient, smart, and pretty cool. Remember, it's a free service and a free call. That's 1-877-ASK-ROSE or visit askrose.org.
Everyone, back to you and the Lyle Podcast Show on the Bachelor News Radio Network. And we want to remind you that there's so many other great shows that's on the Bachelor News Radio Network. And one of those shows is Locker Talk with Barry Barnes, where you can hear about NFL, which NFL just starts. So you definitely want to tune in and listen to Barry. But you can listen to the Barry Show every Friday at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time at Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/LA Bachelor. And the podcast every day from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time as he talks about what's going on in the NFL. So, again, make sure you tune in to Locker Talk with Barry Bonds. But, Keith, let me ask you this question. Should leadership in law enforcement be about rank?
No. Leaders are on every level of the organization. And, you know, you have what's called informal and formal leadership. Formal comes with a title. You know, we all know that a sergeant, lieutenant, and above, that's formal leadership, just that title alone. Now, it doesn't make that person a leader, but that title has a sense of formal leadership. Informal leadership are those individuals who, whether they want to or not, people look up to them. They're that voice of reason. I call them the alpha male or alpha female of an organization. So leadership, believe it or not, is on every level of the organization. People don't think that, and I think that we've got to get more officers to buy into the leadership mindset that it's not about telling people what to do. It's about making the organization better and making yourself stronger.
Yeah, and again, I think, you know, Keith, there are so many people who are not in the position to be a leader, but they have a lot of characteristics and traits that where people will follow them, and because, you know, they may not want to hold that rank as a sergeant or a lieutenant or a captain or even all the way up to a chief, but they definitely have some of the skill sets there. And I think really, you know, when you look at leadership, Keith, at the end of the day, it's about doing the right thing. It's not about doing what's popular. It's about doing what's right and what's right for the community and what's right for the agency. And I think so many times, you know, people get caught up into, as we say, the politics of things, and that politics really gets in the middle of some guys being better leaders than what they are.
Well, you know, let me say this, man. The thing that gets me, you know, we talk about formal and informal leaders, and I'm a firm believer in that. I also believe that there's a such thing as a formal servant leader and an informal servant leader. But I think the thing that makes our job so difficult, Virgil, and to the listeners, is that we are hired to bring our level of expertise into an organization, whether that's to be a transformational leader, a change agent, or what. That's what we're hired for. We're not hired to make the easy decisions. I think the thing that gets you is when you go into an organization and you hear people say, well, we want change, we want somebody from the outside, somebody who's broad-minded, who basically is a visionary. And then when you start making decisions that are not in line with that organization or that subculture's agenda, then you become a bad chief. This is the thing that gets me. How do you know when you are a never been in a supervisory role, you've only been responsible for yourself, how do you know when somebody's making the management move? How do you know that? Is it because you watch, you watch people, or is it because it doesn't meet your agenda? And those are the things that leaders encounter on a daily basis. People telling them they don't want you to advise them how to do their job, but they want to tell you they don't want you advising downward, but they want to advise upward, and they want to skip all the ranks in between the chief, and they want to go directly to the chief. It's the chief's fault. These are people who have no desire to promote. These are sometimes people who stay in trouble, but they want to be able to tell the chief how to do his job, that or her job. That's the interesting part about it, and they can never tell you specifically what you're doing wrong, but they just know you're doing it wrong. A lot of people fold on that, but that's where confidence and faith comes in play with a leader. You have to be confident in your ability to do your job, and you have to make a decision. Are you going to work or are you going to fight? And because you can't do both, so when you do, you work, because that's what you're hired to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And Keith, you know, right before the break, you know, I brought up, you know, we talked about Ferguson, and we talked about a community that was, has a high percentage of African American, but at that time, the police department did not reflect what the community looked like. And so, you know, over the past year or so, with so many things that have happened with George Floyd, even all the way back to Michael Brown, and all the protesting, you continue to hear people who are protesting, who continue to say, you know, why doesn't the police department look like the city that you all are providing police services to? So people have asked the question, does that come back on the leader of the organization to make sure that agency is doing everything that they can to recruit minorities within those police departments, instead of saying, well, you know, hey, we're out here, we're trying, but we're not really getting a lot of applicants. How does that play into the role of the leader of that organization?
Well, it goes back to what I said earlier, Virgil. You got to set the tone and your expectations. And one of the things that I still think we're uncomfortable with doing is we're uncomfortable with confirming to our communities that we are looking to hire minorities, including females, and continually saying that and talk about the importance of that, why it's important. Some people are just comfortable. I mean, they're very uncomfortable with that. And so you have to try new things. You know, the Zoom thing, you know, the chief has to say, this is what my expectations are. Then you have to have the right people in those positions that are also visionary. It doesn't mean that you're going to always agree, but you got to have people who aren't afraid to make those decisions. You got to think outside of the box, Virgil. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you got to think outside the box.
And you've got to push that down to your people. And it's one of those things where sometimes you have to make the decision on, okay, what do you need to get this area jump started? Because, you know, we can say that all day. You know, there's difficulty in recruiting. We're not getting the numbers. But at the end of the day, you still have to try hard. You know, you have to be willing to try new things. You have to be willing to see where I can adjust in the existing things that you're doing. But, you know, that's what a leader does. A leader is there to have vision and share that vision and hope that everybody joins into that vision in order to make the organization. Because today's another day, but tomorrow brings something different, and you have to be prepared to address that something different and something new.
Yeah, exactly. Well, hey, Keith, I want to remind our listeners that if you're listening to the show live on 646-929-0130 is a call-in number. But if you're also in the chat room is open. You can leave a message in the chat room. That message will get to us. Or if you are on live with this, let the producer know if you want to come on air. He's screening calls. And if you got a question or a comment you'd like to come on, please do so, or just leave your message or leave your comments, and we'll get that, and we'll get that answered during the show. But we also want to remind all of our listeners that if you miss any parts of this live broadcast show, you can go back and listen at thebachelornews.airtime.pro. That's thebachelornews.airtime.pro. And follow You and the Law broadcast show. But Keith, you know, so many, even internally, you've got some guys who, and men and women, especially some of large agencies, they may not even see the police chief that often. They may not see the person who they may want to interact with, but how is that an issue with as far as the leadership?
Repeat that question again, Virgil.
So when you've got individuals that are within the police department who the only time they may have seen the police chief was at when they started the police academy, they may not have seen he or she, you know, in a number of years. So when you've got officers who are within these departments who feel like, you know, man, the chief can't be that busy where, you know, I haven't seen him in he or she in a couple of years. So what does that say about the leader of that organization who is not making themselves available to everybody within the police department?
Well, I will tell you, man, that's easier said than done. You know, I used to be able to – I said, you know, man, that's not difficult for a chief to do. But, you know, when I got there, man, I first got here, I made every attempt to meet and see as many people as I can, and I tried to continue to do that. I haven't been able to do it as much lately, but, you know, but people see me. I mean, if nothing else, I have 7 or 8 facilities that I'm responsible for, and – I try to go by each one of those facilities at least once a month to see people. When I see officers out on calls, when I'm off, you know, go up and say hi to them, things like that, talk. So it's important for them to see you, but I think they still understand. I think some people would prefer not to see you. Some people want to see you. But you got to do what's best. People need to know you.
Yeah. Well, hey, Keith, man, we're coming up on taking our second break, man. So we're going to take this break. We're going to get back into the topic of police failures begin with bad leadership. But you're listening to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
Your mother-in-law just dropped in. It's dinner time, and she looks hungry. Time for a quick dinner. Think fast. Think eggs. Like an omelet with tomatoes and cheese. Quick, easy, delicious. So, she loves dinner, compliments your creativity, and finally admits you're not a shameless social climber who stole her baby boy away. All thanks to the incredible edible egg. For other quick dinner, lunch, and snack ideas, visit AEB.org.
The incredible edible egg.
The American Egg Board.
Have you seen that new plastic coffee container? Did you know it actually absorbs aroma from the coffee? At Maxwell House, we think the aroma should stay where it belongs. In the coffee, not the container. Our steel can won't absorb our rich coffee aroma, and unlike plastic, it's a perfect barrier against coffee's worst enemies, moisture and oxygen. So choose Maxwell House with the fresh steel can, and make every day good to the last drop.
Welcome back to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network. If you missed this broadcast, you go to thebachelornews.airtime.pro, the bachelor with a T, news.airtime.pro. Here you can hear this show and other shows. Interesting advertising with them, hit us up at labachelor40@gmail.com. Guys, I have one question for you, and that is, what if the training from the officer who goes through the ranks and becomes the chief is never there? You know, it's like any other job. If you are manager of McDonald's and you don't train somebody the McDonald's way, and that person becomes a manager, he's gonna or she gonna train that person the wrong way as well, and it's a cycle. So what about that, and is that part of the lack of failed leadership in some cases?
Yeah, it is. I can answer that. That's a great question. You know, one of the questions that I ask is that I ask people, who are you mentoring? There are people that think they're mentoring, and they're really not. I don't think people really understand what mentoring is. I don't think people really understand what leadership training is. There are people that will read a book and say they're a leader, but they haven't actually gone through leadership training. That's why I'm really a big proponent of bringing outside training in, because it gives people a fresh look at things and give people a different perspective. You can't have the same people teaching the same people all the time with the same attitudes and the same goals and objectives or the same philosophies. So I'm a firm believer that you have to have formalized leadership training. And I'm thankful that I came from a state that made it mandatory for formalized leadership training when you promote it to each and every rank. That's because that was a priority. Leadership training has to be a priority. Leadership is something you live every day. You don't just go to a class. You don't go read a book. You know, this is one of the things I hate to see people do. I hate to see people go to a class. They come back. They spurt out all this information that they receive, and you gung-ho about it, and the next thing you know, everything's died. You know, that's what it is. So you're right. You have to get the right training. That's why you see police departments go outside to find additional, to hire chiefs. I mean, that's why you see mayors and city managers do that. But that's pretty, you know, it is important, the proper training, because I can put on a training. There's so much training out here on leadership and accountability, but is it quality training? And that's the key, quality training. And cream always rises to the top. I'm telling you, someone who is a good leader, no matter what you throw at that individual, they're going to be able to handle it. And it's not just theory. This job is not all about theory. I mean, there's theory there, but all it's about practical and about common sense. And that's what being a leader is.
Well, Keith, let me ask you this question. Should agencies rethink how police leadership training is implemented?
I think it has to be there's several ways you can do that. I think when you have police departments that have shown that they're not going to do that, I think that's where it's important for you to have those civilian review boards or outside resources that mandate that certain types of training. I think that there needs to be state statute regarding certain types of training. There needs to be some format of mandatory. I think there needs to be some format that these are the trainings that you have to have in order to maintain, in order to be a good standing in law enforcement. But I also think it's the police chief has to establish that training, and his boss or her boss has to hold them accountable for that. So every year, you should be doing an audit of your training to make sure that it is meeting the national standards, industry standards, the needs of the community, and the needs of the officers. You can't do the same training every day. I mean, every year.
Yeah.
You've got to bring in outside training. And so I think it depends on what the situation is, but I think somebody has to. You can't just leave it up to the officers. Or the first, you have to, the chief and the command staff have to make, this is what we're going to do, and you can't make it. There's no open discussion, but there's no discussion about it. This is what we're going to do, and this is why.
Yeah, and I think, Keith, oftentimes, guys think just because they went through some type of a specialized, I'm not going to say specialized training, but some type of leadership training, that they went to a 40-hour class on leadership training. And so now that gives them the skills to be a leader. It's not about just sitting in a class for 40 hours, 4 days or 5 days a week. There's more to becoming a leader. Especially with the authority and power that you have. So can you, this scenario, Keith, that you've seen this just like I have, you, one day you are a sergeant. Next thing you know, the mayor or city manager calls you up and says, hey, I want to make you my chief. So all of a sudden here's this big, little celebration. Now you're standing in front of guys that you were just equal with, but now you're the police chief. You have really no formal supervisor retraining, and the next thing you find out, well, it may be another 4 or 5 months before you are able to attend some kind of leadership training. So how does that impact that person's ability to be a leader? And how does that impact those individuals who are looking at him saying, just a week ago, man, you were just like me, but now you're the chief?
Man, it's a difficult situation. And I tell young supervisors that you got to realize that last week you were one of them, and this week you're one of us, and that's why I firmly believe that you can't be friends with the individuals. That you can be cordial and professional and respectful, but you can't be good friends with those individuals that you supervise. You've got to make a decision. You got to make a decision regarding what your which road are you going to take? Because at some point you're going to have to address something that individual do, but I tell people all this, a person who respects you is not going to put you or themselves in a situation where you've got to discipline them.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, and Keith, I think when we talk about putting people in leadership roles, what also comes along with that is for them to put themselves in a position to be around great mentors and like-minded people who can help them at the same time that they're rising through the ranks. Because oftentimes, Keith, you know, we've seen people who get into leadership positions, and once they get into those leadership positions, you've got some people who are within the police departments. They feel now that person is just a company man. They're just now they've got the position that they wanted, but they have forgotten where they have came from. So, and oftentimes that kind of damages some friendship because, you know, you were one way a year ago. Well, now since you made the promotional to a deputy chief or to a major or a captain, then you kind of have forgotten, well, now I'm in this position, so I've got to conform to the position.
Yeah, it's everybody can't do the job, man. And those are discussions that people have to have with themselves. Because the minute you go to discipline somebody, they're going to bring up some things that they've seen you do or some things they've heard you say. So that's going to be interesting. You know, that's interesting. So everybody, like I said, you got to have those long talks with yourself to see if that's something that you're interested in doing.
Yeah, and again, Keith, you know, everybody is not cut out to be a leader, and not everybody wants to be a leader. Not everybody wants to become a police chief. And so you got individuals who, you know, and I've heard this throughout my career, you've got certain people who feel like certain individuals are groomed, that they're hand-picked, and they are groomed to become the next police chief. They may go through the academy with some of these same people, and the next thing you know, here is one individual who is being selected and is being groomed for that position. So you got individuals looking around. It's kind of like, so what makes that person any different than the other 45 people that went through the same academy class?
You know, man, it's all about heart too, Virgil. Who has the heart and the courage to do the job? And what's your purpose for wanting those positions? You know, what's your purpose? You want to make a difference? You want more money? They don't pay us enough money to do this job, man. The long hours and things like that, they don't pay you enough. So it's all about heart and dedication.
Well, and you know, Keith, you bring up a good point. You got, you know, no amount of money really can for the job that entails to be a police chief. But you've got some people who have said, when they find out, oh man, the police chief up in Boston, he makes $325,000 a year. Man, how does a police chief make $325,000 a year? He's making six figures. And you got some people who are feeling like, well, but then when something happens at the police within that agency, questions come up about this person's leadership skills.
Well, let me tell you something. It's a job that not a lot of people can do, and people can tell you how to do your job. This is just like, you know, I think police chiefs, especially in this day and time, are armchair quarterback more than any other profession or any other position that you have. And
hey,
I mean, other
hey,
position
Keith,
that see, but go ahead, man.
hey, I didn't mean to cut you off. I just noticed that we're coming up on our last break. So we're going to take this break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to be get into the topic of police leadership. But you're listening to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
Come tap your feet and snap your fingers at the home.
Having trouble with math or science homework? Call Rose Holman Institute of Technology's Homework Hotline, a free math and science tutoring service for Indiana students in grades 6 to 12. Call toll-free 1-877-ASK-ROSE from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, Sunday through Thursday. And a Rose Holman College student will help you with your math or science questions. The tutors are patient, smart, and pretty cool. Remember, it's a free service and a free call. That's 1-877-ASK-ROSE or visit askrose.org.
If you're an African American man, you need to know about oral cancer. Oral cancer is more common in African American men than in any other group in the U.S. If you have a sore or lump in your mouth that doesn't go away after 2 weeks, see a doctor or a dentist. Most often these symptoms don't mean cancer, but it's important to get them checked. If you do have oral cancer, it can be treated more successfully if it's caught early. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, National Institutes of Health.
Welcome back to the You and the Law broadcast on the Bachelor News Radio Network, WCOM in Chapel Hill, and our other outlets where you can hear it, of course, the rebroadcast. You can hear this show and any of the other shows at the Bachelor News at airtime.pro, in addition to all the other great shows that we have there as we wobble along here. I want to... a couple of things that came across, one of which I'll ask you guys personally off the air, but start with the stuff that I'm really getting. You guys have been talking about, you know, what if one of your friends works in an agency? What about nepotism? What about, you know, your cousin or your brother, or your sister, your uncle want to come work for you, your chief, or your sergeant, and wherever you are, you got some rank. What about those? How do you handle that? How do you handle the envy? He ain't all that. I remember managing, they're mostly out in the Midwest, TCBY yogurt stores. When, you know, back in the day, I ran a few stores. I was a GM, and I hired my cousin to run as a supervisor. He moved up to manager, but then he was screwing up. Like, he wasn't following protocol. I'm getting calls from my boss. And so I gave him time, and then I let him go. And he had an attitude, and to this day, he has an attitude. So if the performance is not there, and Chief Hump, Chief Green, you know, you guys are you the dogs, and then you hiring people and they not doing a job, there can't be any animosity there. But of course, they may say, "Oh, he think he all that," and then the third element of that is, you know, they go to the race card against you. Oh, he Uncle Tom. Oh, he know he been hanging with the white boys, but now he think he all that and this and that. Your profession, your agency can't be any different than any societal employment anywhere. So if you can address those three folds, if you remember, I'll come back and answer that. And then the second one is off the topic, and that is, what if you are an officer and you quit your job? How hard is it to get back onto another agency if you decide to get back into the profession?
Well, you know, I'll answer the last question you asked, L.A., about if you are a police officer, you quit your job, how hard is it to get back into the profession? For some people, it's not that hard. I think, you know, sometimes we've seen, you know, certain individuals, you know, they go from agency to agency, whether they've done some things at one agency and that's led them to leave that agency and to go to another, or maybe they're just not satisfied with the type of leadership at that agency and they decide to go somewhere else. So I guess it just depends upon that individual officer and why did they actually you know, quit one agency, and or if they decided to. And I've known some people in LA who have actually gotten out of the profession for a number of years and got into the private sector and decided that they wanted to come back, and they were able to, of course, go back through all of the training and everything to become, you know, get recertified. So it's not that hard, but there are some individuals who, for some reason, they have an easier opportunities than others.
And really quick, Chief Humphrey, before you answer that, I guess your profession is just like that. So if you're in the same industry, I mean, in a different industry, like if I'm in broadcasting, if I leave the industry, I guess I got to come back and understand the software and all that and get some formal training. So you just don't jump back in. You got to go back through the ranks. Is it if you left as a sergeant, you got to go back down and train, or you come back and train as a sergeant just to have 30 guys?
L.A., you were cutting out. I couldn't hear you.
My bad. I was saying, Chief Green was just saying, you know, if you leave and you come back, you got to go back through some kind of certification. So do you come back and start it, train, or do you go back to the basics and then jump in? How does it work?
Well, every state is different. Every state is different depending on how long that you're out. I mean, some states say that if you leave, you have a year. You have a year to come back before you have to go back through the academy and get retrained. Some say up to 2 years. There's continuing education courses that you have to take. I know that if someone leaves our department, I do know that they come back, have to go through some forms, methods of in-service training, and not just in-service training. They also have to go back and ride with a field training officer to ensure that they are up to par on policies, current policies and procedures. So every place is different, but, you know, when you've gone, it's sort of like a barber. You know, if you don't keep up your skills diminish. The thing about the difference between the two is that it can be deadly. It can be extremely dangerous for us if we don't keep up with the right skills, right training, and things like that.
Well, you know, Keith, you know, we talked about this on a previous podcast show about training of police officers, if you remember, where we talked about how certain states have very limited training requirements for police officers, and some states have higher training requirements for police officers, or some agencies even exceed what the state requires, such as, you know, like in Little Rock, where you guys require actually more training than what the state requires an officer to go through in an academy. And so, you know, I know in Arkansas, I think if you have been inactive for over, I believe, 2 years, you have to go back through a refresher through ALETA, which is the state academy down in Camden, Arkansas. And so other states are different. In Oklahoma, you can be inactive for, I believe, up to maybe 5 years. And anything after that, you have to go back through a refresher academy. And so, you know, again, every state is different. And so some have different requirements. But I think when we talk about the leadership training, Keith, we are talking about individuals who, to these positions, who may not, who should not be put into those positions. But once they are put in those positions, oftentimes it's kind of hard to get, you know, to remove a person from that position, unless you've got, you know, where it's a, you know, a mayor hires a police chief or a city manager hires them and they, you know, do something to be removed from that position.
Yeah, right. You're absolutely right. It's a lot of pressure.
So,
So,
Keith, let me ask you this. When we talk about, you know, leadership, you know, oftentimes this is a position that you and I know that you want to do your best and you put everything into it. And I think it's, you know, I think for the our listeners that there are police chiefs out there who do recognize when there is a failure in their leadership. There is an act of omission that, hey, I didn't do something right. I'm going to own up to it. But then what happens, Keith, when you have those ineffective leaders who don't own up to those things that have occurred?
It's not a good thing. It snowballs. It shows a lack of courage, and so it's not a very good thing. You know, they don't hire us to make the easy decisions, and there are some that just won't make a decision point blank, and so it's not easy. It's not easy at all. I mean, it's not a good thing for an individual not to make a decision. And people recognize that the troops are watching and the community is watching. So it's interesting that it's interesting, very interesting that, you know, people want the job, but they don't want the responsibilities that come with the job. That's very disappointing.
Well, it is, Keith. And I think, you know, I think that's why so many people, really have a lot of respect for individuals who are put in the positions as a police chief or even as a deputy chief because they know this individual, but they're seeing a different side than what the public is seeing. And so there's two, you know, as a leader, you're wearing, you know, it's, you know, we've talked about this, Keith, where being a police chief is really no, it's almost like being a coach in the NFL or the NBA. You know, if you're not winning games, then you're going to be considered ineffective. You don't have a good game plan together, and you're going to be replaced. Just like with a police chief, if crime is bad, if there's a lot of homicides going on, things that you and I know that you cannot control, you're going to be looked at as that you're ineffective, you're an ineffective leader, and you're going to be removed, and somebody else is going to be put into that position. So oftentimes people think that, you know, hey, once you become a police chief, man, it's easy. It is not, Keith. I mean, you know, as we talked with our guests with a couple of weeks ago, being a leader is someone who you're always trying to become a better leader.
Right. You are. It's a learning. It's a lifetime. You have to be a student of the profession and realize it's a lifetime thing. It's not just a one. You can't turn it on or off. It's full speed all the time. So I don't think a lot of people realize that.
Yeah. Well, hey, Keith, we got a question from L.A. I think we may have overlooked the question earlier. So, L.A., what was the question that you had one of our listeners wanted to ask?
Yeah, basically they were asking, how do you deal with nepotism? Like if you have relatives working at your agency, you know, you have the discipline. I think Chief Hump had talked about it a little bit. You got to do your job, but also the backlash that goes into it. I mentioned my cousin. I had to fire him, and, you know, I think he thinks he's saying them all that. And what about when they also say, you know, when they use the race card against you? Oh, you the house Negro, the field Negro, like you've been hobnobbing with the Europeans, I call them, and you done lost your way.
You know, man, we it's amazing. I've gone through that. I've gone through that where, you know, put a nepotism policy in place. And, man, it got a lot. I mean, that's where some of my pushback and some of my issues started, nepotism policy, because you can't have relatives working with each other for each other. You can't do that. I mean, even if you're trying to, just the perception alone, but blood is thicker than water. And, you know, what I always tell people is that you're telling me that if two siblings working together in a car and something happens and one of the siblings does something in violation of policy, there is a possibility, I didn't say probability, there is a possibility that the bloodline's going to kick in and they're going to be protected. They're going to protect their, not saying that's going to always happen, but just the fact of not allowing that lets it be, you know, it makes it a lot cleaner. You hope, but there has to be a strong policy in place that everyone understands that this is what we're not going to do. This is what we're going to allow. This is what we're not going to do. Yes, it just doesn't look good. It doesn't pass the smell test when you don't have a nepotism policy and you allow nepotism within your organization. I came from an organization that you couldn't even work inside. Even if you weren't a police officer, you couldn't even have a relative work inside the police department. The only way you could be related if you were married while working there, but you couldn't have cousins. Me working there, I couldn't even have a cousin to come and work there. I didn't understand that at first, but as a police chief, I totally get it.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it's just like with any profession, Keith, you know, we're coming up on the last few minutes of the show. But with any other profession, you know, just like, you know, in the fast food industry, you know, you've got a cousin and he or she has hired multiple other family members. And all of a sudden something happens at this fast food place and the next thing you know, everybody walks out. And everybody walks out because the cousin is the manager or the assistant manager, and everybody feels like, well, you done my family member wrong, so we're all leaving. You know, so I think that's why you have to have those things in place, even in the private sector. But in the public sector, in this sector, you really have to have those nepotism policies in place because of you may have a relative that works in records who may have access to information, and all of a sudden they're giving out information that they shouldn't be. And then somebody finds out, well, that's so-and-so's cousin. Well, how did that happen? And so that's why those safeguards need to be put in place, especially in the public sector, especially in policing, because of individuals having access to certain confidential information. Keith, man, we're coming up on the last few minutes of the show, man. It's been another great broadcast, and you know, I think our listeners would appreciate the fact that we're talking about ineffective leadership or individuals who are doing everything they can to become great leaders in their organizations.
Well, I think we got a lot of great leaders out there, Virgil, and I think we're going to bounce back in this profession and be the pride of so many different communities. I think it's coming back. I see some signs of that, but yeah, man, it's a difficult job. Not a lot of people to do it. I believe you're called to do it. I don't think you just pop up one day and do it because everybody can't do it. But I think it's a calling. Some people,
exactly.
Some people the phone is answered. Some people they keep getting a busy signal. So anyway, that's all I got to say.
All right. Well, hey, man, we want to thank everyone for listening to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network.